I reminded him of it.
All right, I will call this meeting to order of the Salary Council, and the first item on the agenda is to approve the minutes of the
Hi, this is Greg Fox calling in.
Hi, Greg, we're just convening the meeting.
Great, thanks.
On the phone are
Greg Fox, Bill Donahue, James Joy, Laura Whitty, Randy Twistle, and Patty Hannon.
And we'll just quickly go around the table so everyone knows who's here. I'm Deborah Olson.
Dave Betson.
Joe Boyle.
Chaz McElroy.
Marcia Vandenberg. Gloria Myrie.
And the staff are Sally Olson and Greg Hubinger.
And Angie Burns.
From the AG's office. First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes. The meeting minutes are in your folders right behind your agenda. Does anyone have any questions, comments, corrections? Do I have a motion to approve?
Mm-hmm.
Second?
Second.
We need to take roll call because
Olson.
Of people on the phone. just a minute. Did someone just join?
Oh. This is Greg. For some reason, I got disconnected, and I've just reconnected.
Okay. We have a motion to approve the minutes. Sally will take the roll call.
Chair Olson.
Yes.
Joe Boy.
I'm not used to being first.
Joseph Boyle.
Yes.
William Donahue.
Yes.
Greg Fox.
Yes.
Patty Hannon.
Yes.
James Joy.
Yes.
Charles McElroy?
Yes.
Dave Metzen?
Yes.
Gloria Myrie?
Yes.
Sherry Pugh? Tom Stinson? Randy Twistell?
Yes.
Marcia Vandenberg?
Yes.
Ben Wilmus? Laura Whitty?
Yes.
The motion carries. The next item on the agenda is the budget forecast, and as you'll recall, this is something that we have to take into consideration before we make our recommendations for the salaries for this. So I will now introduce Britta Raton.
Raton. Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me again. I'm Britta Raton. I'm the State Budget Director with MNB, and I will walk through the budget forecast relatively quickly, but feel free to stop me at any point with questions, and I'll also take questions at the end if that works better. I believe you all have handouts in your folders. At a very high level, our projected balance in the forecast is down from our November forecast. So we released this forecast at the end of February. We are down from our November forecast by $492 million since November. So our projected balance is now $1.052 billion in fiscal years 20 and 21. The biggest takeaways from this forecast is that our revenue projections have been lowered.
Tom Stinson.
Thank you, Tom. We're getting the budget forecast.
Okay.
Our revenue projections have been lowered through fiscal year 2023. And we also are having slower economic growth in our economic outlook, and we'll get to that a little bit later. If you turn to slide three, this gives a picture of how our current biennium is looking. That's fiscal years 18 and 19. We are reducing our projection by $157 million in the current biennium. And walking through what this chart shows, it shows our November forecast on the left-hand side. The middle column is the February forecast, and the right-hand column is the change between the two forecasts. So nothing changes about our beginning balance. Our revenue projections are down $198 million. Our spending projections are down $41 million. So all together, we are down relative to our previous forecast in the current biennium by $157 million. What this means is that we have a budgetary balance projected in our 18-19 biennium that's available to carry forward into 2021, but that balance that's carrying forward has declined from what we assumed in November. So moving to slide four, this shows our lower projected balance in fiscal years 20 and 21. Again, this shows the reduced balance forward by the $157 million, so we're expecting less money to roll forward from 18-19 into the next biennium than we previously expected. Our revenues in the upcoming biennium are projected to decline from our previous forecast by $386 million, and our spending is projected to decline by $51 million. So across the beginning balance change, revenues, and spending changes, our forecast balance is down $492 million, which leaves us with the $1.052 billion projected balance for 20 and 21. So that's the balance that the legislature is currently looking at and putting together a budget to determine what to do with that balance. Turning to the next slides, this provides a look at our economic outlook, slide five. Our economic information comes from our national forecasters, and this is where they are predicting the gross domestic product to be, the GDP to be, looking forward over the forecast horizon. And relative to where we were in November, the economic outlook has weakened. And so you can see the lighter bars is the November forecast of where GDP was anticipated to be, and the darker bars are the February forecast. And the most significant point to probably look at is fiscal year, 2019, where you see the 2.7% growth declining to 2.4% in our current forecast. And so our national forecasters are taking some growth out in the current year and then looking forward. So this does have an impact on our revenue projections. There's a couple reasons that they cited for slowing that growth into 19. The growth from the federal fiscal stimulus is declining. Monetary policy is becoming more restrictive. Global growth is weakening. And there's also a decline in the labor force participation rate. And this is just kind of a demographic story, that as the baby boomers are reaching retirement, there just isn't as much labor force to replace those that are retiring. The next chart shows the state's unemployment rate relative to the U.S. The Minnesota unemployment rate is the dark line. The national unemployment rate is the lighter line, which is above Minnesota. So our unemployment rate remains relatively low. The darker bars on this graph represent recessions, and so you can see since the recession, the Great Recession that occurred 2009-2010, we have had declining unemployment ever since. But we are getting to kind of the low point relative to where our unemployment rate has been at the low point in the previous two expansion periods. Moving to the next slide, this shows kind of the pinch point in Minnesota in terms of our tight labor market. What this is comparing is our unemployment rates to job vacancies. And you can see in 17 and 18, we are getting to the point where the number of job vacancies is exceeding the unemployment level. So it's a very tight job market, and it's getting to the point where employers are having a hard time finding workers to fill the jobs that are available. And so that also has economic impact in terms of our wage growth assumptions, because we just don't have enough workers necessarily to fill the open vacancies. So those are some of the economic indicators. Moving to how our revenue forecast was lowered. This breaks down our, this is slide eight. This breaks down our revenue forecast by tax type. The individual income tax is down $403 million in 18-19 and $571 million in 20 and 21. So that's really the biggest change in this forecast, is in that individual income tax line.
And why do you see such changes in that?
Well, we're seeing changes, we're seeing a reduced level of individual income tax actually coming into the state in our actual receipts in the past few months. And so that's the kind of biggest component right now. Part of what we are trying to determine is the cause of that. So it's hard to know at this point until we get final information on the current tax year.
Do the demographics of the baby boomers and leaving the workforce and then perhaps spending less than 6 months in Minnesota, so not full-time residents, you assume that some of that might be playing into it?
So that's a question we've been getting a lot. We don't have evidence necessarily pointing to that, but that's a place where there's been a lot of speculation that there may be people that are not staying in Minnesota and paying during income tax year.
Thank you.
Yeah. But that's kind of the biggest change in our revenue numbers. The sales tax is also down relative to forecast by $19 million in 18-19 and then projected to be down by $165 million in 20 and 21. Our corporate taxes are anticipated to be up relative to forecast by $130 million in 18-19 and $262 million in 20 and 21. So all of those netting together get us to that total decline in revenues from our previously forecasted levels of $198 million in 18 and 19 and $386 million in 20 and 21.
And we have another question.
On the unemployment, does that include or doesn't include the people like they call them, the people that gave up that are no longer participating?
That
not part of that number?
That it is not part of this number. If they're no longer seeking work, they're not reflected here.
And the gap, like in the second quarter there, is that what approximately in excess of 40,000 between the unemployed and the job vacancies?
It looks to be. I have to admit, I'm not as deeply knowledgeable about this data because it's usually presented by our economists.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Can I make a suggestion that I was on the phone last time. When we speak here, maybe identify who's speaking. It's pretty hard to kind of understand who makes so.
I was Joe Boyle for the record. You were
Dave Metzger. Thank you, Joe. I wonder if you're going to catch that. All right, thank you.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you.
Sure. Moving to slide 9. This is showing how our total growth in revenue, this is a percentage growth in revenue, how that is slowing over our forecast horizon. So in the 18 and 19 biennium, the biennium we're currently in, we're projecting revenue growth about 3.2% per year. In 20 and 21, we're expecting revenue growth at about 3% annualized per year. And looking out into 22 and 23, our expected revenue growth is 2.3% per year. So we are clearly seeing a slowdown in our growth in revenue, and that's just reflecting that overall slowdown in our economy and also that tighter labor market. And so this is something that I'm gonna speak a little bit later about our structural situation between expenditures and revenues in this forecast, but this is what's driving some of our structural issues. Before I move to the expenditure side, I just want to talk briefly about some of the forecast risks on the economic side. One place where it's been difficult for our economists to predict where we're headed with revenues is based on the taxpayer response to the new federal tax law. There was a lot of changes at the federal level, and knowing how people will behave in their with their taxes is hard to predict. And so there are some changes in this forecast where it's hard to discern whether it's just a delay in when we will have taxes remitted to the state or if it's actually a real decline because we haven't had a full year yet of the new federal tax law. The other risks include, again, that slowing labor force growth. As you probably know, there's a lot of uncertainty around trade policy at the federal level and what the impact is on the economy, both for the United States and for Minnesota. Other forecast risks are geopolitical events. For example, if there is a kind of hard Brexit, which sounds like after yesterday maybe is less likely, but if there was a hard Brexit, that could have implications on the economy at a global level. And also, just with any forecast, we have 28 months remaining until the end of fiscal years 20 and 21. So we are making a forecast of a long ways out. And whenever you have that much time for things to change, even small changes can have ripple effects through. So that's just a bit of caution there as well. So there's quite a bit of what I would say downside risk in this forecast. We are kind of at the long end of our economic expansion. There's certainly not a recession forecasted in our forecast, but we are approaching the longest expansion period that we've had. And so as that continues, the risk of a downturn increases. So turning to slide 11, this just gives a look at the expenditure side of our forecast. There really is very little change on the expenditure side when compared to the revenue side. So overall, in fiscal years 20 and 21, our expenditure estimates are down by $51 million. That's just 0.1% of expenditures, so it's really a very minimal change. In our education area, we're seeing a forecast adjustment downward by $48 million. This is primarily due to just lower actual pupil counts, student counts coming in from schools both last year and then initially through this year. We're also seeing reduced compensatory aid payments. That's the aid that's paid based on free and reduced lunch counts in school. So we're just seeing fewer kids qualifying for free and reduced lunch than we previously forecast. And so that's also contributing to the downward adjustment. On the property tax aids and credit side, this is where we are seeing an increase. It's still relatively minor, but it's a $29 million increase relative to our previous forecast. This is because we're seeing increased property tax refunds to homeowners. The dollar amount of those property tax refunds that we have issued this year was up relative to what we had previously forecast. We think this is primarily due to the lower income growth than we had previously forecast. And then in our health and human services area, again, it's a very minor reduction from forecast, just $30 million. There's a couple of offsetting pieces there. Our Medicaid forecast is very slightly up, and then that's offset by some reductions in chemical dependency treatment. It's not because there's fewer people receiving that treatment, but it's because they're receiving it through providers that get 100% federal funding instead of having a 50% state match on that funding. So our state contribution to it is just lower than we had previously forecast. Going to slide 12, this is taking a look at our planning estimates. And this is where you really see the effect of our slowing revenue growth on our structural balance going forward. So what this slide is showing is our forecast revenues in each biennium and our projected spending in each biennium. And what this is doing is taking out of the calculation the impact of balance forwards into those biennia. And so it's just showing the structural balance between forecast revenues and spending by biennia. In 20 and 21, the structural balance is $538 million, so there is still a positive structural balance projected in fiscal years 20 and 21. In fiscal years 22 and 23, our projected spending in our forecast programs on top of the base spending in other programs actually exceeds our forecast revenues by a very small amount, just $11 million, but it is structurally not balanced in 22 and 23 under the forecast. What's driving that is really that slowdown in revenue growth that I highlighted earlier. So you can see the annualized growth on the revenue side is that 2.3%, whereas the annualized growth on the spending side is 2.9% under the forecast. And so we start to have that imbalance between the growth rates in spending and revenues. And then I just want to highlight that we don't include inflation in much of our spending in the forecast, and that's by statute. There are pieces of our forecast that build inflation in because they're based on actual costs, or there is an actual inflation factor built into a formula, but that's only on about 20% of our budget. And so the remainder of the budget doesn't have any sort of measure of inflation built in. If you applied inflation to the spending amounts, you would see a great deal more pressure between spending and revenues. And so this is just an estimate of the impact of inflation on those pieces of our spending where we don't count that in our forecast.
This is Bill Donahue. What is the percentage of inflation for 2021?
I have that somewhere. It's over 2%, but I don't remember the exact. Just a moment here. In 2020, it's 2.21%. And in 2021, it's actually 1.98%.
And my other question is, when you estimate expenditures, do you include the amount of money we awarded in 17 to the legislators? So is that money already in the forecast?
So to the extent that it was appropriated, and I believe, was it appropriated?
It wasn't. That's why the question.
Thank you. Then no. If we only include what has been appropriated in the prior year, and then we push that appropriated amount forward, so we assume for direct appropriations that the same dollar amount continues unless there is some formula in law where we are forecasting a change in that expenditure amount. So for example,
if they made the expenditure, it might not still be included. I mean, they paid the money, I think, and I don't understand exactly. If it's an actual expenditure, you don't project actual expenditures forward?
I believe what she's saying and what our discussion at our last meeting was, although they received the money, they never appropriated it, so they are spending it out of reserves.
Yes, thank you
for that clarification. Is that right? I mean.
Yes.
Yes, you're getting nods.
Okay, good.
So when we do our forecast, we base our forecast on what was directly appropriated in prior years and pushing that base amount forward unless there is a formula in law that drives that expenditure up.
Okay. So it sounds I get it.
Like,
thank you.
Yep.
This is Dave Metzen. That projected balance, about $1 billion, what would that approximately be if they did factor in inflation like we probably should be? Most businesses, I should be very careful, most businesses would do that.
So if you look on slide 12, the estimated impact of inflationary pressure on those expenditures that don't have inflation built in is 1.097 billion. Our balance is 1.052 billion. So they're very close to each other. So essentially,
there's no balance.
If inflation was funded in all areas.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So the last slide I just want to highlight, I want to be clear, we are not in any way forecasting a recession or a downturn. It's just a slowdown in the growth in the economy. But we want to just highlight again that we have a reserve policy in place in Minnesota that is, it gets a lot of attention nationally because it's a very strong reserve policy. So we have $2.425 billion available currently in our budget reserve and cash flow account. And that continues to be available in this forecast. There's no use of that reserve.
Does anyone have any other questions or comments for Britta?
Yes, this is Tom Stins.
Hi, Tom.
hi, Britta. Can you tell me what's assumed for salary growth
in 2021 in the budget for state salary growth?
Yeah, Tom, so as you know, in the forecast, we don't build in any growth automatically for salary on the expenditure side. But in the budget, when agencies construct their budget, we instruct them to assume, they assume flat expenditures, but they assume growth in their compensation costs. So we have not instructed them to include any sort of across the board increase, but that they should assume the regular steps that exist in their contracts. And that's because the steps in labor contracts exist, that pressure exists absent of any approval of an additional labor contract. And so they have assumed those steps, and the size of those steps vary depending on the bargaining unit and the number of employees in each agency that are at the top of their range.
So can you give us a little guidance on what the normal, or what AFSCME, say, progression would be?
Yeah, I believe that in a lot of labor contracts, steps are about 3%.
They vary between 2.75% for AFSCME and 3.5% for MAPE. That was Greg Evinger.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions, comments?
Tom, can I just say, talking about the economy with you on the phone makes me slightly nervous.
Aren't you glad he's in Arizona?
I am glad. If he was here, I would have just said, and now Tom Stinson will want to see the economy.
Thank you very, very much for your time and for providing us this information to us. We're going to move on to the next item on the agenda, which is testimony from some former members. And so I will welcome, you can come up individually, I would say, Joe, and introduce yourself and give us a little bit of background on how long you served, things that you think might be pertinent for our conversation.
I can start. I'm Michelle Fishbach. I was in the legislature for 22 years and just left. I was in the Senate the entire time, just so that these guys know that.
Don't use big words.
But I think that I was asked to be here because, different from these guys, you're rural, aren't you? Rural legislator. Okay, so we have two rural legislators, but I was a rural legislator about 2 hours from here, and I think that makes a difference, a significant difference on how we deal with compensation. But I would pass it on if we're just going to kind of introduce ourselves first.
I'm Joe Hockey. I also did not run for the last election. I was in the House for 16 years, represented Chaska, Chanhassen, Victoria, that area.
I'm Clark Johnson. I live in North Vancouver and I'm represented in District 19A, which is part of Nicollet County, and part of Mankato and Cassota and Mysore County. And I served 6 years, and I just retired. I did not run for re-election.
Thank you.
You might just kind of start in and stop us, I'm assuming, for questions.
That'd be great. I think, in general, what we were looking for was some input from legislators. We can't talk to current ones.
Yeah.
About, since we made major changes 2 years ago as far as the salary goes, and then also the other things such as per diem, as I think everyone knows, we've had long conversations in this council about, so.
And you know, the thing that I was thinking about the meeting, I don't know if you guys have done it, but the per diem, I think, may be handled differently for rural legislators as opposed to, and you might want to check with NCSL, because I know that they send out once a year they do kind of a tax thing for legislators. So
we are aware of the fact that there are some there are some tax differences for if you live within 50 miles of the Capitol or if you live outside of 50 miles of the Capitol. That is one of the reasons we wanted to be sure to hear from someone who is farther away.
And I will say that per diem was important to a rural legislator in the sense that you have to set up an entirely different house. And if you don't eat out, you're buying more groceries. I mean, and my kids were in kindergarten when I started, and I think I had a grandkid by the time I ended. Now I'm trying to think if I had one or two. You have to set up a separate household, essentially. I mean, because you're down here, you know, 4 or 5 days a week at least, if not, you know, towards the end of session. And so there are expenses that, you know, not necessarily that per diem does cover. If you, like I said, if you don't go out to eat, you're buying additional groceries, you're buying, you know, you're setting up an apartment so that you're comfortable. I mean, it's never anything fancy, but there are those expenses when you think about it. You know, I can't go home and eat leftovers necessarily after everybody's done eating. I have to have additional food. So there's things like that I would advocate for the per diem, that it does cover some of those other expenses that you do have that aren't necessarily, you know, that you don't necessarily want to spend a salary on.
Is there expenses on the flip side because you're not at home that you have at your house, you know, like plowing your driveway, doing those things, making sure it's freezing up and stuff like that?
We don't care.
Well, actually,
summer, and yeah. Then you may.
That was relevant to my experience. My wife is my age, and I wasn't going to ask her to shovel snow, and we live on a busy walking street, so it's relevant.
Well, you could.
And we didn't. No, I wouldn't do that. And she really couldn't. So there was the expense of plowing. There's additional expenses. This might seem minor, but you know, dry cleaning. I clean my shirts at the dry cleaner, and just clothing. When I started, I did not have. I had one sport coat and several pairs of pants that needed to be replaced, and so there are some expenses at home that aren't always recognized. I don't know if per diem deals with that, but it's relevant to the cost of being a member. The other thing is that Greg mentioned that the question of do you do per diem or do you do expenses, you know, by actual expenses. I will really plead with you, do not do real expenses. If I had to keep all my receipts for this, that, and the other thing, I found it always a challenge. There's so much going on. And a lot of it is detail work, whether you're trying to figure out the ag budget or biodiesel, whatever it is that you're working on. And to add that on there, I think, would be a big mistake. Prior to my service, I worked as a professor at Minnesota State Mankato. And when we had expenses, we did not have to file our actual, like if I traveled, I did not have to file what I paid for breakfast, you know, the actual receipts. We were paid meal expenses based on some formula that was actually kind of, I wouldn't use that as an example. Never cost the government the cost of breakfast, that was for sure. But that's to keep members away from handling all those little receipts, it would be a wise move on your part, in my opinion.
This is Gloria Myrie. Just to remind all of us, our scope is just salary. So we can't touch expenses, we can't touch per diem, but it informs our decision making about it. And especially
Madam Chair, James Joy.
Hang on a minute, Gloria is speaking.
I'm sorry.
I've said what I needed to say.
All right, go ahead.
One of the things I agree with Gloria's comment there is, one of the things, again, like our last meeting we talked about, is we're looking on whether or not we're going to give them an increase. We're not going to be able to stop per diem. We're not going to be able to stop any of that. So, I appreciate the testimony and stuff like that from the legislators as far as their thoughts on the per diem, but again, our decision today or decision by the end of the month is to task whether or not we're going to have an increase in their salary or not. And I know we got to have fact finding, but we know as far as per diem and that, as far as anything we're hearing on that, we can't make a decision on that anyway. We have to make a decision whether or not we think they need an increase on their salary. That's just my input on that.
All right.
Just, I just don't want us to get too long-winded on per diems and stuff because, again, we don't get any say in that. All so. Right.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear more about the salary, which is where we're charged to deal with. And to me, my question is, was it adequate for the work? Do you really feel you were part-time? And was this adequate compensation? Did you have other jobs? How did it impact that job if you had one? Or if you had other income sources to supplement?
Well, I'll answer that. And this, for those on the phone, this is Joe Hoppe. And as a suburban member, you can spend as much time being a legislator as you want. And the more you're there, the longer you're there, the more involved it gets in terms of, I don't know how many years I was on the LCC and other commissions. And as a committee chair, and I mean, it becomes a full-time job if you let it. There are very few legislators that make money in the legislature. If there are any, I'm not sure. Most people, you can watch your tenure in the legislature, you can watch your bank account balance slowly drop. I think the increase in salary is a good idea. I don't think we want to get to a point as a state where we're paying legislators really lucrative salaries. I think we always want it to be a little bit of a burden to be a public servant. And I don't think we want to. So as a suburban member, I will say it's much more difficult to be a rural member because you're farther away from home, farther away from your job, your family. I had jobs where I could either do things early in the morning or in the evening or just follow up with things on the phone or the computer during the day. It's different if you're running a grocery store in the middle of Minnesota. You just can't do that.
What was your reaction when 2 years ago when you saw what the salary council did?
I wish that it would have happened 10 years earlier. Yeah. In all seriousness, we have lost a lot of very good legislators because people, you know, it's hard enough to be away from your family and your career, your job, but when you're not making any money either, you know, that just makes it harder. And go ahead.
Finish. The other question.
Joe, this is Bill Donahue.
Go ahead, Bill.
Joe, could you tell us what do you think a fair salary for a legislator is? Right now it's 45. Should it be 50? Should it be 40? What do you think it should be?
You know, I think we're early on into this raising the salary process, and I would have the same answer if I were still a legislator. I would be very careful about raising the salary. And I would not get into a habit of raising it, you know, a certain percent every 2 years, because once you raise it, it's hard to go back. And I don't think we ever want to get to a point where we're making it very lucrative for people to be, you know, I know a lot of legislators from other states, and the more money that legislators are paid, then they're there longer and it becomes a full-time job. And as much as this takes up as much time as you will let it, I also like the idea that we're a part-time legislator. And you can be a teacher or a professor or a farmer or whatever and have another job or career. I think it's really valuable to have people that are real people that have real life experience serving in the legislature.
Since you're all not serving now, and maybe are also active with your parties, in the recruitment of people to run, did you find that there was a difference a few years ago versus once you knew that it was a $45,000 salary as far as getting decent candidates to run for office?
I will say I've talked, maybe not literally in every county, but in every corner of the state recruiting candidates, and I haven't done it as much the last couple of years. Usually money's not the big objection. You know, people might only do it for a term or two. Usually the money's not a problem until people get here and find out, you know, because you could say you're making X number of dollars, whatever the salary is, but Representative Johnson mentioned some of the other expenditures. So if you're at your local coffee shop or cafe or bar and somebody's selling raffle tickets or Girl Scout cookies, if you are a legislator, you are the first one that has to buy it every time. And there are a lot of things like that you just can't account for. It just, as I said, you can kind of watch your bank balance go down month after month. So I don't think it hurts being paid a little bit more money. I also I reiterate, I really would be cautious about increasing it too fast.
Do either of you have any comments on the...
First, I would just say, and then if you win, you have to give it back or you don't accept
it.
Oh, you
don't
want to
win.
You don't want to
yeah.
win. So,
you can't
win. Even though you pay for the raffle ticket. But, you know, and I recruited candidates before the increase. And I will say I had a couple really seriously considering because they were leaving jobs or leaving, you know, that they would have to take a cut in pay. And so there was a couple I can say I know one chose not to run. And there, I'm sure there's other factors. I'm not saying that they said I can't do it because of this, but there was questions about that, and there's other factors. I mean, you know, it's a lifestyle. It's not really a job. It's you mm-hmm. do it 24/7. Especially, I think it's even more so for rural legislators because people know where you live and people show up at your house and you know and hunt you down at the grocery store and things like that because you and you know ask you about a bill or something, but. I think the pay does help. I wouldn't have a number that it should be at. If I said you shouldn't raise it, then any existing legislators will never talk to me ever again. So
you are being recorded.
Yeah. But I think there's a balance there too. You know, I think that Joe was correct when he's saying, you know, you don't want to raise it so high that it's, you know, the premier job to have and everybody wants, you know, we're overpaid, but it's and it should be a little bit of a sacrifice. I think it's public service, and we got to remember that.
To respond to Ms. Pugh, it turned out to be a full time job for me. I was for the first 2 years I also taught at part time at the university, and balancing those two proved to be very hard at that time at 62 years old. And I think age had a factor with that. And also remember that not everybody has flexibility in their job. And so you please think about every type of job. Professors have flexibility. Teachers have flexibility. I'm not so sure the welders in my community do. And so that's a very relevant point because we want everybody to be able to run. And I thought I reviewed the document that you enclosed, Mr. Huber, here. And I really applaud your philosophy that everybody should have access to this job, and I mean everybody. And so every, you know, based on the qualifications, and that should, I hope that remains your guiding principle on it. It is a full-time job. You are constantly asked. My neighbors, when you stand up to run for office, and then if you're elected, it's accepted that if my neighbors want to meet with me, I meet with them. It's just, there isn't really a no in there. I really worked on the assumption that there were 2 weeks where I could be gone for more than 2 or 3 days. And those were Thanksgiving week and Christmas week. Because I think there's kind of an assumption in America that those are holidays for everybody, thank God. But other than that, there really wasn't. And so, and then typical holidays, 4th of July, Memorial, those are civic days. And so you were expected, even though I had a tradition of seeing the 4th of July fireworks at Park Rapids, Minnesota, no more. And so it's a joy to serve, it's a really neat job, but there are real experiences on that. Our kids are growing, and so my wife has ended up spending a lot of time alone. There's those costs. As far as raising it, I would encourage you to be open to raising it, and I'll leave that to deciding. And I think, actually, knowing that it would go up, I maybe this is a different political party. I'm real comfortable with inflation built into that, because then you know. My experience in this election, and I just reflected on who ran in my area. I did recruiting and helped regionally with the election. I could identify at least 4 or 5 of our candidates in our region who this is really relevant to. I talked with some before they ran. I don't think, again, I agree with you, it's not really the prime thought process that you go through, but boy, if you win, it becomes part of your family's thought process, and it's very real. And I think the possibility to earn a living wage, and again, in rural, our wages are significantly lower where we live, to earn a living wage was very relevant to a number of people choosing to run who came from non-traditional, you know, lawyers, teachers, you know, from other opportunities. So whatever you can do to expand that base of people who will consider running or can consider running is healthy for the democracy. It's just really important.
Go ahead, Dave.
This is Dave Metz. 2 years ago, we heard testimony, at least from one former legislator. She was saying it's especially hard on women in the legislature. And that was at the lower salary for lots of different reasons. So I don't know if that was just one person or what's your observation on that? Is it harder just because of traditional roles of women? Or we talked earlier, Joe, I think you mentioned, our job is to make sure we have a great cross-section of people. The work that the legislature does to keep the state competitive, we need smart people to make really great decisions, or we're not going to be the state we want to be or what we've been for the last 50 years. So, again, I just want to make sure that, and I've been around the legislature for 50 years, in my judgment, it's gotten a lot better because more women are involved, because I think they look at issues differently and problems and what have you. So I want to make sure, I guess my point is, to make sure that we keep looking at this to, if the female thing is an issue, that's got to be kind of factored into our thinking. And if it's a non-issue now that we moved it up to 45, great.
And I guess the one thing that I would say is, in response to all the questions about, is it on the flip side, it was about the per diem, but I was fortunate enough, I had little kids, but my husband was at home, so he worked out of the house, so we were able to handle that way, and we didn't have the additional cost of child care or things like that. But I do know, and there's a one senator right now who actually, he has little kids from way up north, further than I was, and his whole family comes down. His kids aren't in school yet, his whole family comes down. I mean, if that's what they were thinking is particularly harder on the women, is the child care issues, things like that. I guess I didn't, as I think about it, most families are two income at this point, I think it affects people equally that way in the sense. And if it's mom or dad, most likely they're sharing child care, issues or, time, and so they have to figure out how to handle that. If you're even if you're not getting home till 7 o'clock at night, the even older kids are home alone. I will say I was blessed because my in-laws lived not far from me, so I would just call them and say if my husband wasn't able to be there, just say, oh, run over, and they were there to meet the kids off the bus. So I will say I was very blessed in that sense. But I don't know if it's necessarily harder on women in particular. I think just in general, I think all of those communities that we're looking to have run and get involved.
Joe, go ahead.
We're the Legislative Salary Commission, and I think from what I've heard from you folks is that you're happy you're not on the commission and you have to put a specific number, but you have no complaint about the fact that we might have picked what could be considered a fair and reasonable number. You have no facts that would say it's wrong, nor friends that have said, that was wrong, a big mistake. I mean, you can always hear people say that, but whether it was an educated consideration based upon what's best for the state of Minnesota is another issue. But one of the things we did say is we recommended that the House and Senate consider eliminating per diem. At least I thought that wasn't our business. I think some of you folks have pointed out that there is some justification for that. And I guess I'd just like us to go back to being just the salary commission and not the getting involved in criticizing per diem, especially for rural people. I admit I'm from the 8th. The 8th isn't, whether it's a Democrat or Republican elected isn't my business as being on this committee. But the fact is, I want to make sure that those people are making the choice to run based upon that it's appropriate. And I believe per diem is important. We'll let the legislators who are running for office decide what the appropriate per diem is. I'd rather stay on the salary. And I think that's actually what a couple of members are starting to say now. And I think it's important we focus on that and the appropriate increase. Whether it be under normal circumstances, a percentage, I don't care what it is. It seems like a percentage is certainly warranted this time around. And as somebody said, if we don't have a salary positive budget, you might be working a heck of a lot tougher job than otherwise. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not exactly, I think you have to take it into account. The fact that the legislature didn't budget it, but the Constitution of the state of Minnesota says it be paid, I think we all have to look at that. We don't believe in games on either side. Nobody, you know, we have to make sure people are paid properly, and then it's for the people to decide who gets elected. Anyway, do you folks have any real problem with the per diem per se as you sit here?
Well, I didn't comment on the per diem before, and I will say, and either of you two can chime in, I have not heard a complaint from any legislator about the salary increase.
I agree. And I
think, in all seriousness, I think the salary increase really helped. And we want more legislators like the two of them running, in Democrats or Republicans. We want good people. I didn't weigh in on the per diem, and I don't recall what year this was, but maybe 10 years ago when the House went from $66 to $77 per day per diem. There was a fair amount of pushback at that time that we were not handing in receipts and that we were just getting the cash. I know there was conversation 8-10 years ago, whatever that was. By the way, it's since gone back to $66 per member per day. Not that I'm bitter about that. but having said that, so the problem is, and I fully understand not wanting to keep track of every little thing that you do, and per diem is nice because it just sort of, it helps cover some of your expenses. We might get to a point, and again, not for you guys, but the legislature might get to a point where you either get a legislative credit card and everything is just kept track of on there, and it's all out there for the public to see, and it's on a website that says, you know, gas, food, hotel, whatever. But in this day and age, when most people that travel for business have to fill out expense reports and keep receipts, or you have a company credit card, I think it's becoming technologically more and more easy to do that, and harder to, when you're looking at transparency of government, especially from the legislature, I think it's harder to tell constituents.
So has anyone ever asked you, brought up the expense reports and how most people in business, and I used to travel a lot in business and had to keep track of everything, has anyone ever asked you why you as legislators don't, or has anyone ever pointed out to you that they think that that's a reasonable thing to request of you?
Yes.
And what's your response?
It kind of depends, but it's what I tell people, generally speaking. And I had a lot of these comments whenever this was 8 or 10 years ago, but when I would say we make $31,120 a year plus maybe $6,000 a year per diem, most of those questions went away.
So they just...
They looked at the total amount that we were making and said, yeah, I don't care. It doesn't matter. I wouldn't do it.
And what about the... one of the issues we talked about 2 years ago with per diem was the fact that it seems like there's a wide range of what people take in per diem. What, as legislators, did you see there as far as with your colleagues and, you know, whether some people, for whatever reasons, politically more difficult for them or whatever, what do you think about the unfairness that may be a part of the system?
I'll chime in on that. And so if you're in the legislature longer, senator or representative, and you're involved in more things, if you're a committee chair or a lead on a committee, if you're in the minority, you might have to come to the Capitol a lot more often than other members. When you're a first or second term member, generally speaking, there's not a lot for you to do in your office at the Capitol during the interim. You can do things on the phone or an email, whatever it would be. But if you're somebody that's going to be asked to come down to the Twin Cities, you know, weekly or a couple of times a week, that really starts to add up. And so if you're taking per diem for those days to just cover, you know, your various expenses, that per diem report at the end of the year is going to have, I don't think I was ever the top, but I was always one of them, not always, towards the end of my career, I was one of the people that got more per diem.
That's my experience too, and because I didn't serve that long. And to be honest, I didn't have a great deal of interest in coming to St. Paul a lot away from the session. And so I would only claim the per diem on committee business or a commission of a sort of thing. But I thought that was a fair thing to do because it disrupts your life. But again, I think where I live anyway, my work wasn't here, it was there. And really my work was being with my neighbors and learning about what the multiple school districts do, what the three counties are doing. You know, it goes on, and you know, there's just all of these entities that are wedded with St. Paul. And one of the lines I would use is, I was their partner in St. Paul. Well, to be an effective partner, I had to know what they were doing. And so that was really where my work was, and per diem would not help me with that at all. And that's relevant.
And I'll add one thing to that, because that's important. Much of my time, I drove around my district. I went to meetings, I went to visit with people. My district was geographically a lot smaller. But you can get a district allowance from the state, not per diem and not part of your salary, for in-district travel. And I never did that. And it's different if you're in a smaller geographic area. Frank Ornstein walks everywhere in his district. You know, he's really small. But if you're somewhere where you got to drive to different towns and different school district meetings, that's another thing that becomes an expense. And it's not necessarily per diem. You can get a district travel allowance. But again, it's part of the, you know, a full-time job, and it all adds up.
Your mileage is what
I was going to say, that's a separate reimbursable expense as opposed to...
And I think you guys do it at geographic. You get a set amount. I think Senate does it a little differently, where we actually report mileage. But I never did that either in district.
And do you have any comment on the per diem? Or you?
You know what? I forgot what I was going to add something.
Sorry.
About the, No, that's okay. I wanted to straighten out the mileage stuff, because everything, all of those expenses are done a little bit differently by the House and the Senate.
Right. But they're all categories separate from per diem.
Yeah,
right. Someone on the phone was trying to speak.
Yeah, this is Greg Fox. This is on compensation. What we did last year is done. And if you were going to give us advice going forward for what we should take into consideration when making salary determinations going forward, what would your recommendations be?
You know, I think that Joe had mentioned earlier, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you had kind of said, you know, take it slow and don't always, you know, maybe don't put a 2% or a percentage on it. And, you know, just make sure, you know, all of these, don't do all of the increases, I guess, all at once. I'm guarding my words a little bit, because like I said, nobody will talk to me, but you know, to me, that was a large jump, and I'd been here, you know, 21 years, but and obviously enjoyed it for whatever 6 months I was there for it. But, you know, I guess to continue to raise it very quickly seems like, doesn't seem like the way to go, I guess.
So to that point, if you read our report, one of the things that we said was it hadn't been changed for a long, long time.
Yeah.
We looked at not only, you know, multiple things in Minnesota and employment, but we looked at state legislators, we looked at other county and, you know, state governments. I mean, so we were trying to get a comprehensive handle on pay in general and have things to compare it to. So obviously that was a different situation 2 years ago than we're in today. So if I'm hearing the two of you, at least, you're saying that was appropriate or good or whatever, but not necessarily that the need for a raise each time, each 2 years that we meet is not necessarily the case. Is that a good summation?
I would say two things. One, go slow, and two, the answer to the question on the phone is do just what you're doing. You're taking a very thoughtful process. You're talking to people. At your next meeting, I'd get three other ex-legislators here and get different opinions. But I think the fact that you're putting a lot of effort into going to check and really being thoughtful about this, I think that's the right answer.
Madam Chair, I have a question about this, because, you know, I feel like we made a good choice last time. This time, I think we're at a point of, are we at a good base? Do we need to still get the base high, or are we now at the cost of living? One of the questions I had is, we looked at county commissioner salaries, and there have been numerous stories of legislators who just said, I want to serve, but I can't afford it, and they've moved to the county. Is that real? You know, should we be looking at that as a comparison?
And maybe they have a little bit different story, but I mean, I know of a few legislators. I don't know if they necessarily left. I mean, and if there's news reports of that they've said that, but I know of a few legislators who've left and then eventually became a county commissioner, whether that was their intent or if the opportunity just kind of came about. They missed that kind of life. So I guess I don't know for sure on that particular, if that's what's driving them. I do know that most county commissioners probably do make more. They have a different job too, but I just feel like, you know, I was there for a very long time at the lower wage, and I'm not advocating you not raise it, but all of the seats were full. You know, there weren't empty chairs in the House or the Senate, and I would just say, you know, that a huge jump. I think that we're, and believe Dave said that we're doing a good job. Didn't you say that earlier? The legislature's doing a good job. So, you know, that was a very, and I appreciate the fact that you were trying, you know, we were catching up for lost time, but, you know, a big, huge jump again. Maybe, you know, watch what you're, how you're raising.
Let me enter Dave Metz, and we talk about a huge jump. I'm just kind of thinking, first off, the political realities are that they don't want to raise their own salary. I mean, that's why we're stuck for 15 years, whatever it is. So I would like to take them off the hook. And, you know, whether it's, I don't want to say cost of living or Social Security, you know, maybe somewhat based on what the budget balance is in the state, something like that. So it's automatic, no different than my Social Security goes up or this thing or that thing. A very reasonable, modest rate, but we stay with it versus another committee like this 10 years from now saying, you've been at 45 for 10 years, and you know, if you factored in inflation, you'd be at 55 or 53. So I'd like to have us, you know, and I'm not saying we're going to do it, I'd like to have a discussion or a conversation about that type of an approach to make sure that, again, we have good legislators there and we don't start falling behind and not having really good people running or leaving because of the pay.
Dr. Metzen, I would agree with
Yeah,
that.
Dave, this is Randy Twistle. Yeah, I agree that we have to make it appropriate, but I think if you look at the law, it says that we have to look at this every 2 years. So I really don't want to make it an automatic tied back to Social Security or something. I think it's our responsibility to look at it every 2 years, and certainly we should take that stuff into account, but I don't want to make that automatic.
Thank you, Randy. Go ahead, Clark.
My response to you, Dr. Metzen, is that really the citizens of Minnesota made that choice. And when they voted overwhelmingly to establish this through the amendment process, they want this committee to do this work. And so you benefit from very broad public support. Informally, I was surprised by the number of my neighbors who said, you deserved your, because when it came out, it was the talk of the town for a few weeks. And I was doing some town hall meetings. I remember one in Nicollet, rural town, and a number of people after our town hall said, you guys really deserve that. And I think there's a sense of the people, at least where I live, I'll say, and I gotta couch that because we all live in distinct places. But I really believe that it's important to my neighbors that this process work really well. And they value, the general public really values deeply the legislative process and how we can do the business in St. Paul. And part of compensation, they just automatically understand is relevant to that. So finding that effort that you put in to make that a fair wage, and I think your methodology was strong, although you were starting from a low base, or surprisingly low base, and you basically worked from that, if I understood your methodology. I think you made a good choice. I don't know what else you could do. But that will affect how this works. Again, the question becomes, and I think that you've got to keep answering over this session and then the next 2 years and et cetera, is how do we keep attracting a diverse mix of folks to the legislature? I think is there a correlation? I have no idea if there's a correlation, but this is a more diverse legislature than it was when I started. And it's certainly more diverse than when you folks started. And that's good for Minnesota. Now, I don't know if the salary, I can't say that the salary affected that, but I would guess that it has some impact on it. Because there is a younger, and I think the question also was raised based on gender. I think it's just based on more on age than anything. You know, people my age, I make more money, as I'm a middle class Minnesotan. At this point, in my 50s and 60s, I just make more money than I did in my 20s and 30s. And yet my expenses were greater in the 20s and 30s. So if we're going to attract people in the 20s and 30s and 40s, when they're raising their families and struggling with setting everything up in their household, this wage is very relevant to them, and that was certainly true for a number of our candidates that won this time in my part of the state.
Thank you. Gloria?
This is Gloria Myrie. I wanted to make a couple of points about what we did the last time and how that has affected the budget, because that is what one of our tasks is, to look at the budget. And what we are doing is looking at a budget that doesn't include the appropriations for what we did the last time. And so if we continue to increase in any amount, there's never a catch-up. And so we need to, for me, I have some difficulty with an increase because the budget currently does not reflect the numbers from the last year. Also, as we heard the numbers, if you consider in the inflation, there is no true balance. The revenues are not keeping up with, you know, with what we would need for an increase this time around. So For me, I have great concern about this automatic increase if there is not the financial backup for it.
Charles?
Hi, this is Chaz McRoy. I'm curious for you three and some of your former colleagues in terms of the per diem. It does have a compensation component to it, in that you get retirement based on it and things. What are some of the thoughts in terms of the difference between the Senate and the House per diems? I mean, if you're in the House, you're in the Senate from Painesville, 66 versus 86.
I would like to know why this. I've just been curious why the Senate gets $20 more. It's just one of those quirks that feels to me. I mean
that we voted to do it. That's all I can say. I mean, I think the issue was that we felt like the Senate Rules Committee felt like they needed to give additional dollars for that per diem. And at that time, because actually we were at 96 for a while, I believe, the base pet salary wasn't moving at all. And so I think that was part of
maybe it's cheaper for every 4 years versus every 2 years.
We represent twice as many people.
Well, that's part of it. The political pressure isn't there as immediately.
Yeah.
But I mean, the House actually went, the Senate used to be 96 and went back. The House was at 77, now it's at 66. And I think the reason it went back is political. And I think it's a good point, and I know you're not looking at the deal, but you know,
it's part of the compensation.
But I think the point is, if it's because you have to be here, especially more important to rural legislators, the ones who are further away, then, you know, why is it fair? Is there a fairness issue or a reasonable issue on, you know, why it's different? Because you're all here in St. Paul at the Capitol. Someone on the phone needs to put their phone on mute.
I would like to make another point about this, where you live. And this is really relevant to me. I live well beyond 50 miles. But I have colleagues who live 48 miles, or whatever the number was, or it's 44. I always thought it was 44.
The arbitrary.
Miles. But they live just short of that. And so when I could go hop a train and go to my apartment at 3 in the morning when we closed down shop, they had to jump in their car, and all these suburban members had to jump in their car and drive home. And I did not envy them that opportunity at all. I thought, so there are, but my point is, just because you're less than 50 miles, there's costs associated with this too. And then we start up early the next day. The commute, I thought, you know, partly because I'm a country guy, I'm not used to traffic and all that, but I really thought a lot of my colleagues really had to put up. The other thing is suburban members that we don't have. Suburban members, their school board expects them to be at the meeting during session. Our school board knows that I won't be there. I never went home during the week. I always stay during session up here. And so the pressures are across the board. And I'm talking as a rural member, but observing my my more suburban colleagues. So,
as somebody who lives 32.5 miles from the Capitol, there were a lot of times when I'd have to go home for evening meetings. There were times when I'd go home and watch a soccer game with one of my kids, and then I'd come back to St. Paul. And, you know, there are choices and sacrifices you make wherever you live. And there were, you know, times when people would say, oh, well, it's easy for you, you get to see your kids at night. And a lot of the time you see them, but they're already sleeping. You know, and if you met my kids, that wasn't a bad thing. That's a joke.
That's another topic.
But no, I mean, I think there are, you know, trade-offs and sacrifices everywhere. So
yeah, there certainly are.
Does anyone have any more questions or comments?
I have a comment.
Let me get the... Everybody, okay, and yes, final comments or
thank
things
you... Thank
you
for doing what you do.
Yeah,
and
thank
you
for being
you have more to add
about it. And I think what I'm hearing, what we're agreed on is continue to take the job seriously and to keep examining it, because this does, it affects the larger vision of what the legislature can be.
And I would say thank you, and thank you for the invitation today. I appreciate coming down and, you know, sharing a little bit about what we went through. And, you know, about the compensation and things like that. And like I said earlier, it's a lifestyle, and so there's a lot that goes into it. And I think, you know, I appreciate the fact that, you know, you're not discussing the per diem, you don't have, or you're not, you know, you can't deal with that. But it is part of that whole package that we do that is part of the deal. And I don't envy you guys. They don't publish your home address, do they? Because... If you do raise it, yeah.
Well, we want to thank you very much, because we consider this a very important piece of it, is to get a handle on, you know, who we are representing, not just the state of the residents of Minnesota, but obviously we're trying to do the right thing. And as you pointed out, there's lots of different factors to go into it. So we greatly appreciate your time and your willingness to talk to us.
When Mr. Huberger calls, we say yes.
Pardon me?
When he calls, we say yes.
Well, so you don't have to, and we're not even offering per diem, you know.
I'm just thinking that we should start one of these for county commissioners. Have a little scrutiny on what those guys are.
I won't tell you what county I'm. No.
They do have to vote for their own races, too.
That's true.
This is Dave Metzen. One of the things we heard before and really helped us move it up, even though it was low, we were told by other legislators, retired legislators, that they were really losing the group between like 30 and 40. You know, really smart young people that had to leave just because of family pressure, and we didn't want to get to the point where we have, you know, just people that financially can do it or retired or have the right job. And again, that's part of our motivation, is to make sure that we have that good cross-section. And I don't know if that was your experience, but we were told that we really lost some incredible talent because of the low salary from the 30 to 40 age.
I would agree with that, but I would think as much or probably more than the salary, it's distance from home. Okay. So if you're, you know, you've got a T-ball game or a youth soccer game or something, basketball, volleyball, whatever it is, I can sometimes go home in the evening to see that and then go back to St. Paul. If you got to, you know, drive to Mankato or Painesville, you can't do that.
But that is relevant. Keep thinking that way. I really believe that. I believe strongly about that.
But I do think it has a lot to do with the being away part, too.
Yeah.
That's you know, you have to make your decisions on family situation. And I was fortunate enough that I could make it an hour and 45 minutes to home. And so I could, when my kids were in school, I made it. And I missed things in the legislature sometimes, but I made it the priority
the
not
balance.
To miss that stuff. So it's a balancing act, too. So it's not just, it's compensation, yes, but it's also... if you want to live those 6 months in St. Paul.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Some people seem to need a break. I think we'll take a 10-minute break.
Oh, Madam Chair?
Oh.
Just a brief logistics question. So depending on how long you think the discussion will go, should we order Jimmy John's?
We could stay.
Number four, the
It's a public meeting. You're welcome. Okay, so
thank you all.
Just a quick then for the group. We have some information that you've all been it was circulated for us to review. And then our discussion is, where do we go from here, and, you know, what points that we want to discuss. We would like to get to at least a outline of a report so that our staff people are not frantically doing it. So what is your sense? It's 11:25 right now. Do we want to, we scheduled this for 4 hours if we needed it so that we could basically pretty much finish up a lot of our work and then come back to do a final report. So what are people's feelings about how long we will be here? And do you want lunch?
Hi, this is Greg Fox. We also tentatively scheduled a meeting next week.
Right. And then, of course, the question is, if we only need one more meeting, do we want it next week or the following week?
Yeah. It might depend on when they can draft the report.
If you folks reach some sort of framework of what you want to determine, staff can have a draft report early next week, Monday or Tuesday, for you to review. The process would be to send it out, ask you to provide comments back to staff so we don't violate the open meeting law, and then you could either meet a week from today to approve that, or 2 weeks from today.
So what is our sense of what kind of time frame we want for today?
Seems to me we should plan to go till 2 o'clock, leave ourselves.
Okay, so
discussion.
Have lunch.
Lunch?
Sally's interested.
Okay. So we're taking a 10 to 15 minute break right now to order lunch and anyone who needs to take a break.
And then we're imagining that we'll be talking while we're eating lunch. It'll be here not too long.